Come try new Skyline Dip Cholitos at your neighborhood Skyline today. A warm, soft tortilla filled with their amazing chili and cheese with an extra layer of cream cheese and crunchy Fritos corn chips. At participating Skyline restaurants for a limited time.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. It was Christmas Eve 2010 when the body of 42-year-old Laurie Erica Ruff was found in a car parked outside her husband's parents' home, having ended her own life. Her husband Blake was understandably devastated, but what he'd find in the days after her death would change his perception of their entire marriage. He'd always known about a lockbox in the back of Laurie's wardrobe, a box that she'd always asked him never to open, and he'd obliged. But now she'd passed, he needed to know what was inside. Upon opening the box, Blake's brother-in-law found a birth certificate and a number of different IDs, all belonging to different people. Very clearly, Laurie Erica Ruff was not who she said she was. Blake had been married to a stranger. Laurie's name was one that I'd seen floating about on the internet for years, but I'd never really looked into her case. However, when I recently covered the case of Joseph Newton Chandler III, so many of you reached out and told me to look into Laurie, and I'm glad you did because this is a really fascinating story. In 2016, Laurie's true identity was uncovered, but still to this day, in 2024, we don't really know why she lived under stolen identities for so many years. We don't know what she was hiding from. What we know for certain about the life of Laurie begins around 2003 when she met Blake Ruff. His full name was John Blakely Ruff, but everyone just called him Blake. He came from a very well-off East Texan family from a town called Longview, where everyone knew the name Ruff. His grandparents had settled there during the oil boom of the 1930s and they benefited greatly from this. They were just in the right place at the right time and they became a very wealthy family. Blake has been described by those who knew him as honest to a fault and generally just a very agreeable guy, a yes man, who'll kind of just agree with whatever you put in front of him. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but for somebody like Laurie, somebody hiding a past, a person like Blake would be ideal. Which is probably what drew her to him when they met at the Northwest Bible Church in Dallas. Blake's identical twin brother David had recently met his wife-to-be at a Bible study class at this same church, so Blake took his chance with doing the same and he just so happened to meet Laurie, it all worked out. Laurie at the time was going by Laurie Kennedy and she was said to be a very attractive woman. She was tall and mysterious, she was smart, she was an animal lover, she seemed to be a perfectly nice person. She was a perfectly nice person. And the pair fell for each other pretty fast. I mean, generally in Christian spaces, relationships do tend to move quite fast, and soon Blake's parents were asking to meet her. However, apparently as soon as they did meet Laurie, alarm bells started ringing. Or so they say. I don't really know how much of a part hindsight has to play in this. As you're about to hear, the Ruffs say they were crazy suspicious about Laurie from the very beginning. They say they always knew that something was off with her. But hindsight is a really interesting thing. Your brain can very much change narratives to suit new information.
And I suppose there's no way of knowing for sure at this point, none of us were there when the Ruffs met Laurie. But they say they always knew that there was something a little bit strange from that very, very first meeting. Apparently, when Blake's parents, Nancy and John, first met Laurie over a lunch, they were immediately suspicious because Laurie was very shady about her past. When they tried to ask her about herself, she would never quite give them a straight answer. She said her parents were dead and she had no living brothers or sisters. She didn't know any aunts or uncles. It was just her in the world all alone. When they asked her about school, she said she skipped high school and went straight to college, which apparently is actually possible to do without a GED or high school diploma. So this might not have been a lie, but they did find this very strange. Nancy said that it was virtually impossible to get any information whatsoever out of Laurie. But hey, some people are just like that. I have people in my own life. Getting personal information out of them is like getting blood out of a stone. I know they're not hiding anything, they just don't feel comfortable talking about themselves. Which I personally cannot relate to at all, but each to their own. Like, people like that do exist. But Blake wasn't bothered about any of this. He'd fallen hard for Laurie and he wanted to be with her. He was quite happy just to take things at face value and move on with his life. It really does sound like a match made in heaven. When Laurie told Blake that she didn't have any photos of herself when she was younger, she had nothing of her family, he didn't ask any questions. She said that she'd had a really bad childhood and didn't want to relive it, and who is he to question that? Like, why is he gonna make her relive the things that she says she doesn't want to relive? Blake's family just couldn't let that be though. They couldn't just accept Laurie for who she was, and they constantly fought back about it over the years. Why was she so shady? When the pair got engaged, John and Nancy wanted to put an announcement in the local newspaper, which Laurie refused to allow. She didn't want the attention. She wasn't like that, she said.
Lowe's knows you don't want to sacrifice reliability for savings. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select LG appliances and purchase two or three select major appliances to get an additional 10% off. Save big on LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
And then, less than a year after meeting, the pair ran off and got married alone in a church outside of Dallas. And the only person there was said to be the preacher. I can only imagine the Ruffs didn't like that at all. After the pair married, they bought a house 125 miles away from Blake's parents, just outside a tiny place called Leonard in Texas. The house was on this country lane, it was on 2 acres of land, and neighbours again have said they were always very strange. Once again, I do wonder how much hindsight comes into play here, but apparently the neighbours would barely see the couple. Laurie would just sort of like walk the perimeter of the property in the evenings, as she'd avoid all eye contact with people. She just didn't seem to be a very social person, but neither was Blake, it seems. But even Laurie's job was relatively antisocial. At least Blake went out and worked. Laurie was kind of always very seclusive. Secluded? Seclusive, is that a word? It feels right, I don't know. Laurie worked on her own freelance as a mystery shopper, which is the biggest fear of all retail workers. Mystery shopping is basically a method used by marketing research companies and businesses to ensure that customers are receiving the highest care and service when they go into businesses. So basically, people like Laurie would go into a shop organisation and secretly make note of everything that goes on: customer service, cleanliness, health and safety. And then they'd go back and report to whomever has paid them for the job. She spent a lot of time working at home on her computer, making these reports, looking for new jobs, but that was her job. Like, if that's what the job called for, then that's the job. But Nancy said it was always really weird how much time she spent on the computer. But it was her job, so I don't think that's inherently strange. So was Laurie a bit odd? Sure, but some people are just a bit odd. Not everyone fits into a cookie cutter mold of what a woman and wife should be. But there's one thing that Laurie wanted more than anything, and that was a baby. Apparently, her and Blake struggled to conceive for a really long time. She suffered with several miscarriages, which absolutely devastated her. And in the end, they had to go through fertility treatments until they finally had their long-dreamed-for baby girl in the summer of 2008. Laurie was overjoyed that she finally had her baby, but according to Blake's family, it didn't appear like she had much experience with children. Something about researching this time in Laurie's life, though, made me so uncomfortable, because the only point of view we've got is from Blake's family, who clearly didn't like their daughter-in-law. They've said that she was an extremely overprotective mum, that she wouldn't let the baby chew on things, she snatched things away from her constantly. They make it sound like Laurie was almost a bad mum instead of just caring for her child. I think Laurie just loved her daughter very much. She'd gone through a lot to finally get her. She was settling into motherhood and all of the anxiety that comes along with that. The whole storyline of this time of Laurie's life just seems really biased, but there's no other narrative to follow here. No one else was speaking about what was going on in this time, so we've only really got the Ruffs' word of what was happening, but they clearly didn't like her very much. I don't know, it just seems a bit mean, but maybe they were right. Maybe what they're saying is entirely true. Maybe that's just their perception, but I can't help but just really feel for Laurie in this time. Nancy said that Laurie never left her alone with the baby, despite her protesting that this was their 9th grandchild and they knew what they were doing. Honestly, from my perspective here, Nancy seems to be a bit like a nightmare mother-in-law, but annoyingly, it does seem like she was right, because Laurie was hiding something. Like, we know she was hiding something, but I don't know. I just feel really bad for her. I don't know. Apparently, when the family would get together, Laurie would sneak off for very long naps. Relatable, and she wouldn't want to spend time hanging around in the kitchen just chatting to the other woman. Laurie would apparently spend ages tracking their family's genealogies and like the Ruffs family's genealogy, but obviously never her own. She spent a lot of time collecting all the family recipes, but she clearly felt uncomfortable hanging out with them. If I'm doing my own psychoanalysis here, it seems like this was a woman desperate for family connection, desperate for her own daughter to know where she came from, to be connected to her family, but only on her father's side. Blake speculated to journalist Maureen O'Hagan for the Seattle Times, maybe she wasn't even comfortable around her own self. How could she be comfortable around the family? I'm assuming something really tragic must have happened. Something awful is what it appears to me. Maureen O'Hagan's journalism was a huge source for me in making this episode. She was kind of the one who first covered this case. I'll get more to that in a little bit, but I'll leave her articles linked down below along with the rest of my sources, as always, if you want to actually go and read them. Blake also said that after their daughter was born, their marriage just started to fall apart. He said that Laurie didn't like his family. It clearly seems like his family also didn't like Laurie, and she didn't want their daughter to spend time with them. Also, she was weirdly trying to connect her daughter to that side of the family constantly through the recipes and the genealogy. It was just all a bit convoluted. Blake, who was clearly very close with his family, said that this was a really difficult time. So in the summer of 2010, he filed for divorce and moved out, moving back in with his parents 125 miles away, and Laurie apparently just couldn't cope with this. Neighbours report that she seemed to lose a lot of weight really quickly, and she also appeared to unravel mentally. She was frantic, incoherent, unable to focus. She clearly was not in a good place at this time.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
A neighbor called Denny made efforts to help Laurie out in this time. He invited her to counseling at the church where he was a pastor, and she brought him in notebooks in which she had written very strange ramblings about her life. writing about everything that was wrong with her and how she could get him back, him being Blake. Denny said she was also constantly fidgeting, she was playing with her hands, she was speaking in circles. She would repeat the phrase, "This is what's going on with Blake and me," over and over again. Her mind seemed to be stuck on Blake and she seemed to be very obsessive about it. Blake would later say that when they were married, he remembered Laurie taking some sort of medication for maybe ADHD or Tourette syndrome, which is wild to me because how can you be married to somebody and not know what medication they're taking or what they're taking it for? Like, I get married in 2 months and there is nothing I don't know about my fiance. If she's taking medication, I know what it's for. Like, I ask the question. The idea that you can be married to somebody and not know what their diagnoses are and what medication they're taking is, that's insane. They were married for like 6 years. Eventually, Blake did join in on these counselling sessions too, but he brought along his identical twin brother David, who just seemed to do all the talking for him. And unsurprisingly, this did not help fix the marriage. Blake couldn't talk for himself and Laurie's mental state was clearly unravelling. She was obsessed, but the pastor neighbour said that he could never quite pinpoint what it was she was obsessed about. She just sort of like had the same rambling thoughts over and over and over again. As the months went by, Laurie just got worse. She began sending threatening emails to the Ruffs. I don't really know what the contents of these emails were, but apparently they were threatening. She struggled to hand her daughter over for her custody arrangement with Blake. And one day the Ruffs said they noticed one of their house keys were missing and they assumed that Laurie must have been the one to take it. Eventually they go to a judge and ask for a cease and desist. And again, I just really can't help but feel for Laurie. She was clearly struggling mentally, something was wrong, but nobody seemed to be doing anything to help except for her neighbour. I have no doubt she was really hard to deal with in this time, but maybe I'm soft, I don't know. My heart just really hurts for her. And then on Christmas Eve 2010, so December 24th, Blake's dad John was heading out to pick up his paper from the end of the driveway when he came across Blake's car on said driveway idling. He looked inside and saw Laurie dead. He immediately went into the house and called the police, who found that Laurie had ended her own life with a shotgun to the head. Alongside her, they found an 11-page letter addressed to my wonderful husband and another letter for her daughter to be opened on her 18th birthday. The police report stated that these were the ramblings from a clearly disturbed person. So again, just no empathy even from the authorities. But it wasn't thought there was anything particularly strange about Laurie's death. She had clearly been on a downward spiral for a while. Her ending her own life wasn't particularly surprising. But now Blake had to sort out their affairs, and going through their home was a job that he didn't really love the idea of. So instead, he sent his brother-in-law Miles to get the job done. Miles literally said to journalists with the Seattle Times, Maureen O'Hagan, that they called a deputy sheriff to meet them there because they didn't know if the house was booby-trapped. Like, what? Like, what was their idea of this woman? Like, just how far did Laurie spiral in the months before her death? Like, was that a reasonable thing to assume? I really don't know. Just having one side of the story here is absolutely killing me. Upon realising that the house was actually not booby-trapped, the first thing Miles did was go and find a locked box in the wardrobe that Blake had told him about. A box Laurie had asked him never to open. Miles used some tools to simply pop open the box. While doing so, found a load of official documents, one of which was a court document dated from 1988, showing that that year Laurie had changed her name. Before that point, she was Becky Sue Turner. Finally, confirmation that Laurie had indeed been hiding something for all of those years. The family had been right. And it just so happened that a private investigator lived next door, so the Ruffs took this information to them and asked them to do just a little bit more digging, like find out who Becky Sue Turner was. They just wanted to know more about Laurie slash Becky's past, but they were out of luck because the PI quickly found that Becky Sue was dead and had been for a long, long time. In fact, Becky Sue Turner had died when she was just 2 years old in 1971. She'd been the victim of a house fire alongside her siblings in Fife in Washington. Becky Sue Turner could not have been Laurie's real name. It could not have been her birth name. At some point, she'd stolen Becky's identity and then in 1988, changed her name to Laurie Kennedy before marrying Blake and becoming Laurie Ruff. So the Ruffs knew once and for all that Laurie wasn't who she said she was. But who was she? Now they had Laurie's daughter to look after and they wanted her to know who she was, like where she came from. They wanted to have the answers for her. In 2011, so the year after Laurie's death, a man called John Velling got involved in this case. He was a special agent at the SSA, which investigates the fraudulent use of social security numbers. He received a folder full of all the documentation the Ruffs had about Laurie, and he thought this was going to be an easy case to solve. He thought he'd find this woman's name really quick, and he'd get to the bottom of what she was running from. But it would turn out he would have a very long wait ahead of him. This case would only be solved by DNA, but we'll get there. So, in 2011, Velling starts his investigation, and he finds that Laurie hasn't lived as Becky Sue for very long. Records show that in early 1988, Laurie had requested Becky's birth certificate in California, which was Becky's birth state. In the 80s, it was very easy to request documentation like this. I'm not entirely sure what Laurie would have had to have shown to access it, but I'm assuming it wasn't ID. I tried to do some research, but this is a very niche Google search and I couldn't find the answer. So if anyone does happen to know the details of requesting somebody's birth certificate in 1988 in California, feel free to leave a comment. Like I said, very niche. But it does seem like a lot of places would just send these kind of documents to anyone who asks, like no checks in place. Becky had been born in California, but she died 2 years later in Washington, something which was noted in newspaper articles about this very sad story. So Laurie likely knew what she was doing when it was Becky's life she decided to take over. She knew that bureaucracy between these different states would likely mean that she was less likely to get caught. Birth certificate in one state and death certificate in the other. It means it was unlikely to flag on California's system at the time, whatever kind of system that might have been. So she got the birth certificate no problem and then headed to Boise, Idaho, which is where she applied for an ID card in Becky's name. She claimed she was 18 years old, which was Becky's age. She'd been born in 1969, but the Ruff family always suspected that Laurie was older because she struggled to conceive so much. They would turn out to be correct, but barely. Like, the real Laurie was just 1 year older than Becky Sue was. But it would seem that Becky Sue Turner wasn't the end game here, because after getting hold of the ID card, Laurie, the Jane Doe, I suppose, headed to Dallas, which is where she appeared in front of a court to legally change her name to Laurie Erica Kennedy.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
This whole process was very long and laborious. I can imagine it was very emotionally draining for Laurie. But the big question has always been, why? Like, what is somebody running from that means they willingly go through all of this? As somebody who is just so scared of getting in trouble, scared of getting caught for things that I don't even know I've done, I can't imagine living life like this, just always being scared of getting caught. No wonder Laurie eventually lost it. So now, summer 1988, Jane Doe was officially Laurie, but she now had to get the most important thing, a social security number, because without that, she wouldn't be able to work, she wouldn't be able to apply for government benefits, she wouldn't be able to get a house. Like, it's pretty important that she has that. Nowadays, it's harder to fake an identity in the USA because people get their social security numbers at birth, and then you just guard it with your life. But back in 1988, you could just apply when you were a teenager before you started working. And that's what Laurie did. Under her new name, she applied for her social security number and got it easily. Voila, she was free to live her life. and the first thing she did was apply to college. And somehow she did manage to get in without having any high school transcripts. No one's really sure how she did that, maybe she just had a really good sob story. But a few years later, she graduated from the University of Texas with a degree in business. She officially had her whole life ahead of her. Special Agent Velling did put a lot of effort into tracking down people from Lori's past and found a few friends and colleagues from around this time. There was one person who said that she used to work as an exotic dancer, a stripper, and that she had breast implants, a detail that Lori's medical records did support. Maybe this could be a lead, perhaps there would be a serial number on the implants, maybe they would lead to another name. But you quickly found that A, she'd got the implants after she was already Lori, and B, she'd been cremated after her death so she couldn't be exhumed and re-examined. There was nothing to look at there, so that lead died pretty quickly. Velling also obviously looked through all the papers in the lockbox and found that Lori had written a load of sort of like random notes. She'd written North Hollywood Police, 402 months, Ben Perkins, amongst loads of other things, and these all could have been leads or could have just been random notes that she'd made over the years. From these notes, Velling speculated that maybe Lori had been trying to run from the police, that she'd committed a crime, maybe 402 months was what she was looking at in prison. Ben Perkins was the name of an attorney in LA, so Velling got in contact with him, but he'd never heard of a Lori or a Becky. In fact, he was a black attorney who focused on providing his services to clients in the African American community, and he'd never once taken on a white client. Velling exhausted every single avenue he could think of to try and find Lori's true identity, who she was before she was Becky. But eventually, he just hit a brick wall. Obviously, fingerprints also led nowhere. Like, there was just nothing more he could do apart from put her story out to the public and hope that someone recognised her, that someone knew more of her story. So that's when he turned to a reporter that he knew at the Seattle Times, the aforementioned Maureen O'Hagan, and she was the one to tell Lori's story publicly for the first time. The story ran on the front page and then other papers picked up and soon it became huge. It really captured the attention of the public, but still no helpful leads really came forward. And this is when Velling partnered up with incredible genealogist Colleen Fitzpatrick, one of the co-founders of our favourite non-profit DNA Doe Project. She also runs Identifinders International, a genetic genealogy consulting firm that helps identify victims and perpetrators of violent crimes. So Colleen Fitzpatrick kind of knows what she's doing when it comes to identifying people. Through the roughs, Velling managed to obtain samples of Lori's DNA. The family, like I said earlier, really wanted to one day be able to provide Lori's daughter with some answers as to where she came from. They knew that she was going to grow up, she was going to have questions, as anyone would. And it just so happens that her daughter shared Lori's DNA. If the daughter was able to provide a DNA sample, 50% of that was Lori's and that could be used to investigate. So they did just that. They got the daughter's DNA, they extracted the maternal DNA and stuck it through some databases. But there was no good match. They found some distant cousins, but that wasn't really much help at the time. They also entered the DNA into NAMIS, a nationwide archive of missing and unidentified people, in the hope that maybe Lori's bio family had been out there searching for her, but still, no match. They then put the daughter's DNA on Ancestry.com and 23andMe, hoping that at some point, somebody in the family would upload their DNA and it would strike a match. This was the long game, but for the moment, it was all they had. Like I said at the time, they just had the name of some distant cousins, but they didn't really have anything solid, and there wasn't really much that Colleen Fitzpatrick could do with the information that she had at the time. And so she would just check in every so often to see if new names popped up. But as it was, the connections were just too distant to be of much help. However, eventually, after staring at a lot of names, she decided to focus on a third cousin and starts to build out the family tree, which is a massive, massive task. It sounds like it'd be something that's really easy, but honestly, it is not. Colleen said she spent hundreds of hours on this job, just building out a family tree of a random third cousin in the hope that it might sort of lead to a connection. Trace this cousin's ancestry all the way back to an Irish great-great-grandfather born in 1848, and then followed all the branches back down, eventually coming across the name of Michael Cassidy, which was a name they'd already kind of struck a match with. Like, Cassidy was a name that was popping up a lot. So she kind of knew she was on the right track, that she did have Lori's family tree. She tracks down Michael Cassidy, who lived in Philadelphia at the time, and using public information that was available, manages to build a picture of the Cassidy family.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
She realised that Laurie's mother pretty much had to be one of Michael's aunts, but there was no way of knowing which one. And Velling, Special Agent Velling, did agree, but from here there wasn't much more they could do apart from go to talk to the family in question, like do some on-the-ground research. By this point, it's March 2016, and Velling decides that he's just going to fly to Philadelphia himself. But instead of going straight to talk to Michael, he instead goes to speak to another family member. He goes to this person's workplace and just decides to talk to them and hope for the best. The worst that could happen was that he would just get dismissed, told to go away. The best is that he could get some answers for himself, for the Ruffs, and for Laurie's biological family. So he starts to tell this female relative this very long and convoluted story of Laurie Ruff, and then gets out some photos, putting them on the table. And immediately upon seeing these photos, the woman exclaims, "My God, that's Kimberly." So he goes to speak to some more family members, all of whom confirm the same thing. That face was Kimberly, there was no doubt about it. Brief investigation did find that Kimberly's mother was Michael Cassidy's aunt, Deanne, who was married to James McLean. Together they had daughter Kimberly McLean, who had disappeared 30 years ago in 1986, and a DNA test quickly confirmed the match. Laurie Erica Ruff was definitely Kimberly McLean. Now, Kimberly grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia with her family. She had her mum, her dad, and a sister. And we can't know for sure the details of her childhood, but her uncle, Tom Cassidy, said it was a very typical suburban childhood. Family dinners around the table, playing in the garden, like plenty of love to go around. But when she was a teenager, Deanne and James divorced, and apparently Kimberly just didn't take it too well. Deanne got remarried to a man called Robert, and they moved to a different suburb, a different high school, and Kimberly just never really adjusted to her new life. When she was 18, she moved out and moved about half an hour away, and then one day she told her mum that she was leaving for good, for them not to try and find her, she was going. And true to her word, in 1986, she just disappeared. There are a couple of years here that are blank, like we don't really know what Kimberly was up to from 1986 to 1988. It seems she did move around a lot in this time, probably just trying to figure out her next move. But we know in 1988 she got hold of Becky Sue Turner's birth certificate, and we know the story from there. The big question everyone has in this case is why? People expected to find some big, huge secret, something that Laurie slash Kimberly was running from. But from the outside, it seems like there was nothing. There had been so many theories over the years, but it turns out that Kimberly wasn't on the run from the police. She wasn't wanted. She hadn't gone AWOL from the army. She hadn't been involved in a cult or involved in anything dodgy, at least as far as anyone can tell. I do wonder if there's some dark secret the McLean family are keeping under wraps, if Kimberly maybe suffered some trauma in Philadelphia that made her want to leave. But of course, I don't know that for sure, it's all speculation. It's just the only thing I can think of that makes any sense. An 18-year-old girl deciding to leave her seemingly very normal family for good when there's nothing wrong from the outside. The Cassidys still now can't make sense of it. But it does seem like the pressure of the lies got her eventually. She clearly couldn't cope in the months before her death. And what gets me is Laurie never even shared her secret with her husband, like with Blake. If I was on the run, but for no particular reason, if I just changed my name and wanted to start afresh, I would marry somebody that I felt comfortable sharing that burden with, somebody that I could talk to. Like, why did Laurie never tell her husband what was going on? Be like, listen, this is the situation. I was born under this different name. I didn't go with my family. I just wanted a fresh start. Here we are, all on the table, but I am Laurie now. This is who I am. Why did she never do that? Like, it still feels like she was running from something, like she was hiding something. It doesn't seem like from the outside she had anything traumatic happen to her, but we never know what happens behind closed doors. This is just a truly baffling story, and my heart hurts for Kimberly slash Laurie. Like, what did she go through to do this? What kind of mental state was she in at the time? She was just a baby when she ran away. She was 18. To make a decision when you're that young and have the conviction to stick to it no matter what? Like, you really have got to wonder what happened to her. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye, guys.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.